Senate Resources to order. Today is February 20th. The time is 8:03 a.m. Committee members present today, Vice Chair Senator Dyson, Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator French. I believe Senator McGuire and Senator Machicki will be joining us shortly. Welcome this morning. We have Nancy Jones doing our recording secretary. Teleconferencing is managed by Thatcher Brower. Thanks, Thatcher. And my staff, Lindsay Williams, is here. We're going to hear from our consultants from Analytica this morning, but before we do, despite the obvious that this committee is the hub of information on this subject, I do want to commend to everyone last night's Senate Finance Committee meeting with Black and Veatch doing a presentation on some fiscals as well. It was a very informative meeting, so that would be worth watching. But for today, we are hearing from Nikos Tsafos, thank you, and Jenik Mayer of Analytica. Welcome, gentlemen, if you'd come to the table. And you have a presentation for us today, and then opportunity to ask questions. Welcome.
Madam Chair, for the record, Jenik Mayer, partner in Analytica. Had our bios enough times now that I don't know we need to spend extensive time on them, but of course this is my third year working with the state legislature on oil and gas issues. For the last many years, I worked on and eventually led the analytics team at PFC Energy doing detailed financial modeling and fiscal terms analysis. Hand over to my colleague Nikos Tsafos.
Thank you, Jack. For the record, my name is Nikos Tsafos, partner in Analytica. My own background is in natural gas and natural gas consulting in particular, and so that is the lens through which I look at the world, and there's my bio there. I've been enough in front of you that I think we can skip it. What we wanted to talk about today was four things, and we only have one or two slides for each section, so it's not going to be too long of a presentation. We wanted to start by talking a little bit about this question of whether Alaska LNG is in the money or out of the money. We wanted to talk about in-kind and in-value and present some modified slides of what we showed you earlier. We want to talk about midstream options and the MOU and show you some numbers on cash flows on that. And lastly, we want to talk about cash exposure. What I mean by cash exposure is a lot of members are asking us, you know, what is the state of Alaska on the hook for if it takes equity? So I wanted to show you some of these numbers, what they look like. So I wanted to begin with this slide, which is a slide that Jenik and I showed a few weeks ago when we talked about the fundamentals of the LNG business. It is a slide that you have heard in various forms iterated by a number of people in front of you, and it basically says that there's a lot of LNG out there. That's basically what it says. Western Canada, Lower 48, possibly Latin America, East Africa, West Africa, East Mediterranean, Middle East, Russia, Russia East, Russia West, Southeast Asia, Australia, lots of resources out there. And I think the point that we wanted to make here is, first of all, a lot of these resources also have considerable risks associated with them. And I think there's a tendency that I've noticed when working with oil and gas companies, they sometimes tend to sort of look at their project and identify all the risks with their project and then discount all the risks that everyone else faces, because from a distance things sometimes look much better than they are up close. But the key thing that I wanted to talk about when I look at this chart is to reassure you a little bit and to really draw a key distinction between an expensive project, a project that is out of the money, and a project that doesn't get built. And those, I think, are three very different things. And to talk about that, I want to go to the next slide. And I wanted to transport you a little bit in time, and I wanted to tell you, what would that map have looked like in the mid to late 2000s? At that time, I was at PFC doing forecasts for LNG supply around the world, so this is the world that I was looking at the time. People were very interested about Trinidad. Trinidad had just brought on a train in 2005. They had proposed a fifth train X, as it was called. At some point, Venezuela laid out plans for 3 separate LNG facilities at Delta Carib. Nigeria had just brought online Train 6 at its facilities there, and it had Olokola, Brass, and a number of other projects proposed. If Nigeria basically built out everything it said it was going to build out, it was going to overtake Qatar. It was going to be huge. Equatorial Guinea had just brought online in 2007 a project. 2008 and 9, people were working on a second train. North Africa was really opening up. Algeria was very aggressive. They were going to basically increase exports by 50%. Libya had just opened up the deal with Gaddafi that brought in back oil companies. So Eni, Shell, and BP had all proposed LNG projects there. Egypt had just started up, very exciting. They were going to do more and more. Norway was bringing online a project at Snøhvit. They were looking at expansion. Stockman, this field in Russia, had just finalized its partners, so everyone was finally excited about that. Qatar had placed a moratorium on new projects, but Iran was still going. Iran had still many projects. Myanmar at some point was thinking about whether to export its gas by pipeline or LNG, perhaps a familiar choice for people sitting in this chamber. But Australia was moving very slowly. And Russia up there obviously had a lot of gas, but it's huge high costs. And the reason I put this chart up there is because none of these things happened. None. Train 5 got canceled. Trinidad never got anywhere. Nigeria is based at the same point that it was at that level. Algeria finally built some projects, but they basically just offset some old facilities that they had that they shut down because they were too old. Stockman got stuck. Snøhvit didn't go anywhere. Iran didn't go anywhere. Myanmar chose pipeline. Russia didn't really go anywhere besides what was already underway. And everything happened in Australia. And the reason everything happened in Australia is because all these other things failed. And so when companies were looking for supply, when you start crossing everything off the list, whatever remains is the place you go. And the key thing that I wanted to point out here is Australia was by no means the low-cost choice. This wasn't a supply curve where you went to the cheapest, you got the supply, then you went to the next, and then you went to the next, and you built all the way up. All the cheap stuff, which is basically all this list, just never materialized. Wow. And the reason I say that is because it's important to distinguish between an expensive project, a project that is out of the money, or a project that doesn't get built. And just because there are a lot of other projects out there that may be cheaper than Alaska, doesn't mean that all are going to happen, or doesn't mean that you are not able to compete in that market. At the end of the day, what really matters is whether Alaska can sign contracts for a price that makes the buyers and the sellers happy. At the end of the day, that's the only thing that really matters. Whether those buyers are looking elsewhere as well is interesting, but it's not necessarily particularly relevant for this conversation.
Nico, Senator French had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe you could drop a footnote on the Snøhvit project, because the Black & Veatch royalty study we have says that it went online October 2007.
First train, yes. Mm-hmm. Expansion, Norway weighing expansion to Snøhvit. So it's a train two. So the first train came in 2007. This is correct. Okay. There was an expansion proposed. Thank yes. Thank you for that. And so I wanted to put that out there purely to tell you that, yes, Alaska LNG is an expensive project, but it doesn't mean that it's an impossible project. At the end of the day, what you look at is what do you need to sell your gas for versus what is someone willing to pay for the gas. And Alaska in particular has a number of attractions which we've talked about. But there was one more I wanted to highlight, because I've noticed just how excited some of the folks I know in Japan are getting about Alaska. And one of my good friends, he works at the Institute for Energy Economics in Japan, and he was giving a talk at the Brookings Institution in January, talking about the shale gas revolution and implications for Japan. And he kind of went through the motions, and then he had one last section, and he said, guys, don't forget about Alaska. And what was interesting is for him, what Alaska represented that was really exciting was it wasn't just that it was close. Is that if you go from Alaska to Japan, you don't cross any choke points. You don't cross the territorial waters of any country that Japan is concerned about. It's really open seas. And he was really excited about that, because when the Japanese look at where their energy comes from, they get really worried about the South China Sea, about the Malacca Straits, about the Straits of Hormuz in the Middle East. And Alaska was open seas. And so the point is that there's a lot more to price that determines what project gets built. Let's now move to slide 6. You've seen a version of this before, and we've talked a little bit about in value versus in kind, and my colleague Janik is going to go through the numbers. What we wanted to put up here is just to give you a sense of a very simplified version of what the four options, by no means exhaustive options, but the four options that are effectively before you. One is a status quo, no ownership, in value for the gas. The state of Alaska doesn't really have a share of the CapEx or the OpEx, and the state of Alaska doesn't really have cash commitments. It has no debt because it's not taking a debt for the project. And the tariff, you know, it really matters for the valuation to come up with a price at the wellhead. That's what the importance of the tariff is. The HOA says, okay, we move from in value to in kind. Ownership percent in the upstream is still zero in terms of the ownership. Obviously, there's royalty. 25% in GDP, 25% in the LNG. Therefore, you're on the hook for 25% of the CapEx for these two things. And then your cash commitments are basically any principal and interest if you borrow money. And then the tariff in that structure is notional because the state of Alaska is transporting gas through a pipeline that it owns. And so its own gas is going through its own pipeline. And so the tariff is notional. It's purely for your internal purposes because it's Alaska paying Alaska. And so we wanted to look at that, and then we'll go to the bottom of how the MOU changes that structure, and want to go through the numbers for each one of these options. And I'm going to hand it over to my colleague, Janik Mayer, to talk us through these numbers.
Thank you. This, of course, is a slide you saw last time we appeared before you last week. We wanted to put it back up here for a couple of reasons. One, to correct the slide typo in $120 to $110 per barrel of oil equivalent. We've also added to this the dollar per MMBTU LNG price so that people can start to get a sense of how the two different measures relate to each other. But we wanted to come back again to talking about this question of in-kind versus in-value and the idea that counterintuitively by going through the status quo, as Nikos says, taking royalty and production tax in value, that far from insulating the state from, in particular, from price exposure, actually counterintuitively in many ways one increases the price exposure. And the reason for that is that by solely looking at the wellhead for value, you have this enormous fixed cost component in the scheme of things, the sort of $66-odd of tariff that would apply to all of the different midstream elements combined that actually amplify the effect of movement in price. It seems to me one of the best ways of thinking about this more abstractly is thinking about the impact, for instance, of another form of fixed claim, in the same way as a tariff is a fixed claim on the cash flows from a pipeline. Your mortgage is a fixed claim on the portion of the value of your house that is covered by that mortgage, right? So if I buy, say, a $100,000 house, put down $10,000, with a $90,000 mortgage, the value of my house appreciates by $10,000. The fixed claim remains the same. My investment has doubled. The value of the house depreciates by $10,000. The fixed claim remains the same. My entire investment is gone. So a 10% change in the value of the house can give me a 100% change either way in the value of my investment. Leverage, in that sense, increases your exposure to price risk. And as we go through some of these slides, that idea that any form of fixed claim, whether it's a loan from the bank or having another party build some piece of infrastructure and paying them a tariff for that, these are all fixed claims that are a form of leverage that increase your exposure to price. So by taking value by solely taxing the wellhead, even though the state isn't directly paying a tariff itself by calculating the wellhead value on the basis of that implied tariff. That's a form, essentially, of economic leverage that is increasing the state's exposure to price and to price risk.
Senator Dyson had a question. Janet?
I don't know if it's too early, or, but the part on the bar chart that says tariff, I'm confused, because then it goes down and says, looks like it's saying the tariff is the entire guaranteed return. What am I missing in the picture?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, the idea is, first of all, that in comparison to the world of oil, where the tariff combined for all of TEPS and marine transport and everything else is maybe $10, here this is a world where the tariff is as much as $66 per barrel of oil equivalent. And what we're saying here is, if you take the approach simply of taxing the wellhead value, because this is a fixed claim, it's essentially the same as saying this part of the stream, regardless of what the price is, whether the price is $120 per barrel of oil equivalent or $70 per barrel of oil equivalent, this piece is always going to get its return first. We take what's left over after that, in the same way as the bank is always going to get its money.
I got it. Sorry that I missed your analogy there.
So the other slides that we presented last time, we're then taking that intuition and looking at the result by running it through our model of the project and looking at the sort of world of royalty and production tax in kind as a 25% gas share with a corresponding equity share, and the idea that we do indeed see that effect, where the world of in-kind participation actually gives us less exposure in low prices, but similarly less upside in high prices, that it's actually counterintuitively reducing the state's price exposure rather than increasing it, precisely because we're removing a substantial part of that element of leverage from the equation as we do this.
Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this slide, again, I'm going back to the Black and Veatch study, and does this take into account their warning that we could lose up to 70% of the value of the royalty gas by taking it in kind? Is there any reduction, if you will, in the value of the in kind gas because of the marketing issues and the other factors that the Black and Veatch study pointed out?
Senator French, the chair, it's an excellent question. As I think I noted last time, it's absolutely a terrific question to ask. We have assumed, in this sense, the same LNG price for
parity
for all producers, yes.
Totally.
And
right.
if one were to say there is a specific impact on the state of Alaska that it receives a poorer price than others, it wouldn't change the slope of that line, but it would bring it down in the red line case.
And I mean, maybe just for, if I could, Madam Chair, maybe just for the purposes of analysis, it'd be handy to see a slide where we lost, say, 25% in the translation from value to in-kind, just to kind of give us a better idea of what may be our first or second year's experience as we gain ability in marketing gas.
It's an excellent idea, Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. And let the record reflect that Senator McGuire has joined us.
The other thing that one can say on this is exactly what the slope of the line one ends up here also depends on a range of other factors. Precisely as I say, the tariff that comes, either the implied tariff through taxing at the wellhead or the physical tariff that one has by having other parties build the infrastructure and paying them for it, is just one form, essentially, of leverage, a fixed claim that increases the exposure. There will be other forms of leverage that will be discussed as this project develops. The assumptions that you see here, most of the results that you see from Black and Veatch, assume a 70% debt, 30% equity capital structure behind the project. Again, what that means is that the state is, if it's a 25% participant, is only on the hook for direct cash for 30% of its total capital call for its share of the project, and the bank then fronts up the other 70%, and that would be the same for the other producers in this notional world. And then the bank, of course, has first claim on the cash flows from the project. And again, it's that same idea of the fixed claim increases the leverage, increases the price exposure. And so in that sense, and on the next slides, we'll look at this in some more detail. But if one is to... This represents the pure in-kind world that the HOA sets out before getting into the detail of the MOU and the question of what goes to TransCanada. If one has a third-party participant in some portion of the midstream, you're again bringing back in some element of a fixed claim into the system, and the question then becomes, what's the ideal way of juggling that? Because by going with that world, you're reducing the state's initial upfront cash outlay exposure, and that's an important thing to manage. The state has limits on its abilities to finance this, but you're also reducing cash flows that come and giving someone else first call on some portion of those cash flows that come. And so there's a balancing act between what you're doing in that participation versus the decisions that one is making further down the track on things like overall level of debt and equity in the project. And these two things can balance each other out. A bigger share for TransCanada could mean that the state needs to take on a little less debt in doing this, and so it evens out the risk-reward that goes with that, the price exposure that comes with higher leverage. So it's a question of thinking about all fixed claims in that sense as a form of leverage that can be balanced against each other to achieve a degree of price exposure that the state is comfortable with. This is the other slide that we presented last time. As Senator French most acutely noticed, there was an error in one of the data points where they didn't add up to 100. On this slide, we've corrected that, but we've also updated the model to reflect a few additional things, in particular factoring in the fact that under Senate Bill 138, costs from a production tax purpose remain claimable against oil taxes, regardless of whether they come from oil or gas expenses. So to that extent, in fact, in talking here, we talked about the state having a 25% share in the entire midstream from gas processing down to the LNG facility, but not having to front up the cash for upstream development. In fact, effectively, by having those costs be deductible against oil taxes, there is an after-tax state contribution towards upstream expenses, and so those are factored in here in the numbers that we present now.
Madam Chair?
Yes, yeah, Senator French, question.
Actually, this does bring up a question I've had about the sort of overall government take of the project. Black & Veatch says it's from 70 to 85%, and does that match up? I mean, do these numbers reflect that? Because it seems like we're splitting the net present value, you know, you might almost say just 50-50, just glancing at this slide between the state and the feds and the producers. Am I missing something?
Senator French, the chair, that's an item that we have on our list that we'd like to sit down with Black & Veatch and discuss in a little more detail to understand their modeling and our own, because I think we probably do have a slight discrepancy there. And I think we want to understand in better detail the sources of that before we comment, if we could.
Madam Chair?
Hello? Yes.
Well, I guess, I mean, you and I may have different ideas about the word slight. Would you mind loaning me a slight amount of money? Because I think there's like $20 or $30 billion at stake here. I'm just teasing you. Yeah. It's morning. Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So to look then specifically at the world of the MOU, it starts off with that overall 25% share across the midstream that the HOA entails, and then has a number of possibilities. Option one would be that the state exercises its right to purchase a share of the TransCanada vehicle that is responsible for the state's 25% of the gas processing and the pipeline. So if we were to exercise that to the full 40% envisioned in the MOU, it would end up effectively with a 10% stake in that portion of the midstream, 40% times by 25%, but still 25% share in the liquefaction project. the alternative is to not exercise that, have no stake in the upstream or in the pipeline, and only retain the 25% stake in the liquefaction project. And so what each of these things would mean in terms of overall project cash flows, and again, as Nico says, the idea of what the state is on the hook for, particularly in those years of construction, or what we wanted to look at briefly over the following slides. For those who can only see the screen, but not the printout, my apologies. In addition to the two lines on that chart, there are some grey bars that show the world of the pure 25% stake of the state of Alaska, of a 25% stake in gas treatment and processing, pipeline, and LNG. So those are the grey bars on the chart. And then the effect on total cash flows of TransCanada having 100% of gas treatment and pipeline, the red line, and if the state exercises its equity option and TransCanada only has 60% of that 25% share, the effect on the cash flows is that yellow line. Obviously, the intuition is what you would expect, which is to say having an additional partner in this decreases the cash exposure in the early years and correspondingly means that one takes less of the cash in later years. You'll notice this is a little different to the chart that some of you may have seen presented by Black and Veatch, which shows a similar reduction in exposures in the early years, but a much smaller reduction in cash flows in the later years. I think you'll note if you, and I think this has probably been talked through already, on that analysis subtracts out the state's 6% cost of capital as a notional cost of saying, well, the state could be earning this otherwise, so we'll take this out of the equation when we look at the subsequent cash flows. Our own view, and I think that's either the administration or Black and Veatch may also have updated that analysis more recently, is that in trying to understand at least the overall project economics, it's best, first of all, to understand the actual cash flows from the project and compare those to what one might get from another investment rather than subtracting one from the other. So that's why we've presented it this way.
Sure. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Janik, do you have a position on the 7.1% that TransCanada wants to assess, and they say that's because it's an equity loan, if you will? Do you have a position about whether or not that's fair market value, that the state could do better, or just want to hear your thoughts.
Senator McGuire, through the Chair. It's an excellent question, and in many ways particularly relevant to the sort of headline that we put on this slide to say that financially the deal is equivalent to a loan, because again, it's that idea, it's a fixed claim on the cash flows of the project, that for the stake of the capital that they put up every year, they're making a 7.1% return, or I think, in fact, for most of the life of the project, just under a 7% return. There is a 12% under the memorandum of understanding. There's a 12% cost of equity, a 5% cost of debt. A 70-30% split between those two in creating weighted average cost of capital, which gives you 7.1% during construction and for any subsequent expansions. But once the pipeline enters service, it's a 75-25 split, which gets you just under 7%. And, of course, the other thing to understand with the MOU is there's also that rate tracker differential that applies, that this actually gets set at the time of final investment decision. And so we know what the actual rate is depending on how the 30-year Treasury has moved between now and the time of final investment decision. And there is risk in both directions, but I would suggest possibly primarily upward risk in where that may move over the next several years. But that's also a decision that can be made at that time, based on conditions at that time. So if we think of this solely as another form of leverage, another fixed claim on certain cash flows, then I think the first thing you'd say is, if that were all that we were looking for from this deal, it would be better off getting money from capital markets in the form of debt, because we can raise debt more cheaply. Clearly, though, this isn't all that the state is looking for from such a deal. There are a number of questions. One, what limitations there are on the state's total ability to carry debt through such a project, and the difference in that sense between TransCanada doing this versus the state doing this through debt is that this isn't something that's on the state's balance sheet. But more than that, there are all the other issues that we've talked through in much more detail over previous sessions of this committee in terms of having a professional pipeline operator with a stake in this project looking to expand, a company that makes its money by moving molecules, not by selling them, what they do to the overall partner mix. It seems to me there are many different pieces to this, different things that they bring to the table. So on the one hand, if you look at it strictly in cash terms, you could say, well, this is a bit like an expensive loan and why do we want to do that? But there are a number of other things, it seems to me, that they bring to the table. The premium that comes with that form of leverage versus others versus what they bring to the table for that premium that one ultimately needs to weigh.
Thank you.
Janik, Senator Bishop had a question.
So along those same lines, you know, the slide says akin to a loan, and with your response to Senator McGuire, I mean, then you can't lose sight of the leverage that I don't know how you could qualify it as it is real money, and the leverage being we're having a lower tariff rate for in-state use of gas to Alaskans by having TransCanada able to negotiate and keep that tariff lower to us because we Alaskans want to see some value out of this project besides cash to the Treasury is direct cash back in their pocket for a lower tariff at the burner tip for homeowners too. So there's that value built in here too that's not showing up, you know, for the people that are listening at home. But if you model that tariff rate savings over 40 years, that's a real number.
Senator Bishop, to the chair, that's certainly true. The one counterpoint to that is important to raise is notionally, were the state to simply take that 25% stake itself, it has a very low cost of capital and could arguably charge an even lower tariff. So what one has to weigh against that is, does the state also have the ability to be an effective pipeline company, particularly when it comes to expansions, and if it is the sole partner in an expansion, does it really want to get into that business by itself in the future? And how do all these things weigh in combination? Finally, to look very briefly at that question then of what the state is potentially on the hook for. We've looked at solely at net cash flow out in the first years of a project's lifespan in a number of different scenarios. The first thing that you'll notice is that even in the in-value, no-equity world, there's negative cash out. And that comes back to that question that I mentioned previously, which is that because costs are deductible against oil production tax, and also because, for instance, costs are deductible against both state and federal corporate income tax, when effectively, simply from there being investment, and in this case, investment in the upstream on the production tax, and then the entire investment in that sense when it comes to state and also federal, though obviously that doesn't show up here, corporate income tax, there is effectively a negative cash impact of that to the state. So that's the first thing to understand, is that investment, particularly investment on this level, by itself creates an implicit liability to the state. In a world in which the state has the full 25% across the value chain, that could be close to $5 billion in total cash outflow between probably the closer to $3.5 to $4 billion that one would have in actual cash call for the capital outlay, although again that could be higher if CapEx was higher, and then also the impacts through production tax, through state corporate income tax, which are also factored in here. The path of the MOU reduces that by up to $1.5 billion by again, having another partner to share some of that capital burden. And so, and again, this shouldn't be taken as gospel in terms of how cash is actually spent through the project. We're a very, very long way off from knowing what those plans are and how they will look. This is simply to give an indicative idea, and if anything, we've tried to be as conservative as possible by saying, well, maybe up to 30% of the cash could be spent in 1 year, which is how you get to the, for instance, the negative $1.5 billion in 2023 in the state of Alaska. We've tried to say, well, what's the most cash of the total value we can imagine being spent in 1 year, and what does that look like as a yearly outlay to the state?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator French.
Thank you. This is one of my favorite slides. I think you guys did a great job on it. I really like it. But I guess as I'm looking at it, and it's certainly not my business to suggest what other committees should do, but I just imagine David Thiel sitting in the audience, looking at this and developing a big stomach ache as he envisions the state of Alaska spending $1.2 billion in the year 2023 on a project. You guys don't know him, but he's one of our legislative financial analysts, and he's a person who worries a lot about the fiscal future of the state and where we're going. And I just think it's worthwhile to point out that making, you know, in a year when we're looking at deficits, in a year when we're worrying about how long our savings will last, the public should be thinking about where the money will come from in these long out years, multi-billion dollar outlays of cash, even under the most, you know, sort of small and narrow or smallest investment option. And I just had to say something about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
One thing the slide covers is the variation in the potential cash outlay depending on what deal was entered into, right? Could you talk about that sort of sliding scale of the lowest to the highest potential outlay in those years on this slide?
Senator Machicki, through the chair. So as I say, there is always some outlay, even in a case of not participating in kind at all, simply through the tax system. So in a peak year, that could be half a billion or just over in a peak year of construction versus $1.5 billion in the case of equity at a 25% level throughout the value chain. By having another partner, TransCanada, as proposed in the Memorandum of Understanding, that $1.5 billion peak spending annual exposure can then be clawed back to $1.2 billion by having someone else do some of the heavy lifting on the pipeline and the gas processing.
Follow-up, Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure, in all due respect to Senator French, sounded like a scary statement for those living at home. The reality of it is Alaskans would like some gas available so that their futures can look a little brighter and we can have some, you know, potential industrial activity and such. But there's a cost all the way across the value chain, no matter how we choose to participate. And our discussion is about, do we want to share on some of the upside, or do we want to sit back and have it all be sort of outside of our control? And I think it's important for Alaskans to understand that.
The other implication is, of course, if we don't participate at all, would the project go forward at all? So another consideration. Thank you, Senator Machicki. Further questions at this point? All right. Go ahead and proceed.
Chairman, Nikos Tsafos, for the record, if I could add one more thing to both the comments from Senator French and Senator Machicki. The other part, which we've talked about, I think, in previous presentations, is there is nothing that prevents you from offloading part of that 25% along the way if it gives heart take to too many people, in the sense that you may think a little bit more strategically, and sort of going to what Senator Giesel just said, is it may make sense for you to have a 25% share today and for the first 1, 2, 3 years before the project has momentum, but you may also decide at that point that, hey, when we look at that, it's a lot of money. My sense is, again, without speaking, no one has told me this, but my sense is there will be a lot of people that would be very happy to take some of that share off your hands if you feel like it's too much, because there are people that are looking for LNG and people are looking to invest in the assets. So that's why Jenik said, don't take this as gospel. This is, you'll be spending actually that money that year. But we did want to put something out there, because I think a lot of the questions that are coming are what are we on the hook for, and so we wanted to show you a range of what are you on the hook for, but then there are multiple ways in which you can mitigate exactly what that number looks like over time. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. One quick follow-up.
Yes, Senator Machiki.
So I'm sort of assuming in most of the analysis that we've seen that we're kind of assuming the state's capital at 6% and the cost of capital from TransCanada at 7.1. Is that correct?
Senator Machiki, sorry, Chair, if I could clarify the question, I didn't understand the question about the state's cost of capital.
Well, essentially, our AAA rating, or the cost of our capital is less, is lower than the cost of TransCanada's capital. Is that correct? So are you assuming ours at 6% and, or are you assuming the state of Alaska, I don't want to make it sound like mine or something, but all of ours at 6% and the cost of borrowing TransCanada's capital at 7.1?
Senator Machiki, through the chair, the cost of debt entailed under the MOU for TransCanada, of course, is 5% versus comes up to somewhere around 7% when blended with a 12% cost of equity. Throughout the modelling that we've done, and there are only probably two or three slides previous that actually are looking at the returns rather than these, for instance, that are looking simply at the cash outlays in the early years. But where we look at the returns, at the moment, for the sake of simplicity in the analysis, for keeping as many variables the same, because we're looking at sort of directional analysis, as economists like to say, ceteris paribus, when you change just one or two variables, what happens? We're modeling everyone with a 5% cost of debt. We can at some point do some analysis that shows different partners with different costs of debt and what that does to the economics, but we're not doing that at the moment.
Okay. That might be something interesting to see that scale. I assumed you were using 6. So what would you call a realistic scale for the cost of capital over the next 30 years?
Senator Machiki, through the chair. So 6 might be the state's opportunity cost of capital. It's not the state's cost of capital. It can borrow substantially less than that. At some point in this exercise, I think we would like to look back at the data and understand in terms of long-issued notes what the state in recent years and in the past has been able to borrow at and what we think at the time of FID it might be able to before coming up with a specific answer on that, if we could.
Madam Chair, I just think it's something we do need to understand. If we're assuming the difference that the value in the TransCanada relationship is, you know, 1.1%, the reality of it is that difference could be much higher.
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, and that's you're absolutely right. As Janik said, we are not using that same 6% as a minus. The way we look at it, the state has two numbers: what it can borrow, which is the cost of debt, and then what its opportunity cost, which is alternative uses for funds. And so we will definitely work through that analysis and show what that difference is. But we are not assuming, and that's why this chart here, 11, shows bigger variations, because we're not assuming that it's just a 1.1% difference. We took a slightly different approach to that question. So we will definitely make sure we put some numbers in, especially as we go towards Senate Finance and the financial questions become more important of looking at all these permutations. But I did want to underscore just the difference between the cost of borrowing and the opportunity cost. And people talk about 6%, that's the opportunity cost, not necessarily the cost that you can borrow. You can borrow at much less. The question is up until what point, right?
Finally, the last slide is simply to alarm you. This is to look at saying, well, thus far we've assumed a 70-30 debt-equity ratio, and that in talking about cash that the state would be on the hook for, it would be 30% of the corresponding capital call. This is simply to say, well, what if the state decided that it wanted, and again, we've been talking about leverage and leverage increasing price risk and other things, if the state wanted to reduce that, for instance, and do this all through equity, if the state was uncomfortable in taking on as much debt as entailed, what is the absolute maximum, at least in a base case cost scenario. Of course, if it's an even higher cost scenario, that could increase this even further. But what's the maximum in a base case cost scenario if the state were financing this entirely through equity rather than a substantial portion through debt that the state could be on the hook for? So we just wanted to present that as well.
Good. For questions, Senator French.
I appreciate Janik saying base case because if we have 20% cost overruns, we just multiply everything by 20%. And would that be from the $60 billion figure? I mean, these are the ranges you've given us are from $45 to $60 billion cost of the project.
$45 to $60 billion cost of the midstream. We've included, in addition, I think sort of $3 to $4 billion in upstream costs over and above that. But this is
GTP pipe and LNG plant.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Stick.
Other questions?
Just to make sure
it's
I am.
Chicky.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. So essentially what you're saying is if we overlaid, I don't have enough, or slide 8 with slide 13, is that what we would gain for the in-kind, although the initial outlay is higher, what we would gain is more downside protection. Is that correct?
Senator Machiki, through the chair, that's correct. You could flatten that red line even further, if you wanted, by doing more through equity and less through debt. There are, of course, other ways that you could change that line that Nikos referred to the last time we presented here, through things like S-curves and other things on the actual sale contract one has for LNG as well.
And then a better understanding is slide 11. Just the long-term cash flows for the state between those two cases, the in value and in kind, is fairly substantial. If you're looking at it's hard to say what the value is annually on that scale, but over the long term, it's a substantial difference.
And Senator Machiki, through the chair, particularly if one is looking solely at the question of undiscounted cash flows, it's a substantial difference. If one looks at the net present value of what the state is giving up, we can present some analysis on that. It's a relatively small piece of the total value of the project, but in terms of pure undiscounted cash flows, absolutely, it's a significant reduction in the upfront capital required, but it's a significant reduction in the total cash flows from the project that come. And to clarify, it's not about in value versus in kind. It's about in the in kind world, giving a piece of the midstream to a third party.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much. We have reached the end of our meeting time. So I will adjourn the meeting at this time. Reminder that our next meeting is tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. We're going to continue talking with consultants, so bring your questions. So at this time, I'll adjourn. The time is 8:52 a.m.